Thanks, Matt. This has been it's been a really fun it's been a fun 2 days. We had the reading yesterday in Portland, and we've had a lot of chances to talk about like a lot of stuff, poems and lipstick and we took a walk today, just kind of around town, and we were walking in the neighborhood here, and the sidewalk was about to end, and we looked down, and Penelope said, "Is that a dead squirrel?" So this is my dead squirrel poem. I think it's a dead crow poem now. My uncle was a physician, a surgeon actually, and in the 70s he had invented a way to suture the kidney so that it's when they started doing successful kidney transplants. So he's just really intelligent guy. He's a really fine chess player too, just super smart. Eventually, he really started to kind of he started to kind of lose it. This is about that. Tito's Field. Before Tito June began to ramble about the latest gorgeous prophecy, crackling in his Walkman, swatting at the swift flies no one else could see, this man, my uncle, was a genius. They paid him to figure out a way to suture kidneys shut when there was none. Then he'd go home to wreak his 5-foot-nothing havoc on his sons and wife. And because the five horsemen and their fairy counterparts were quick to trample out my Tito's last few lingering flint sparks of logic, my auntie, in the end, stormed out of their house with their sons, the same way reason must have stormed out of my uncle's brain. But for one summer, everyone and everything kept their tenuous residence long enough for me to shoot guns in a field that belonged to my raving uncle somewhere in the middle of Louisiana. Tito June explained each weapon's caliber and range. He even knew the physics of every echoed blam. My aim was terrible. I was just a Jersey kid, drunk on the triple jump 20-gauge cuss and rumble of a shotgun, thrumming its way out of that 17-acre field in a hurry. When he told me to knock one fat grackle off the lowest branch of a bare catalpa about 40 feet from where we stood, I surprised myself when I hit the bird and saw the body drop, still fluttering. Tito June pulled a .22 off his hip, walked up to the final full twitch that remained of the bird, and sent a slug through its gut. When he picked it up and held it by one toe, dangling it like an iridescent planet, I knew he'd packed that one away with all the other critters in his freezer. Maybe some of you are thinking I should thank him. My genius, Tito June, who cackled loud when he pulled the trigger, cackled loud when he didn't. Yet, for all his quirky brilliance, for all his ravishing lunacy and universe-be-damned bravado, I don't envy him his dreams. Their gun blast echoes rippling through the field of his mind, littered, tangled, overgrown, where every day he stands, gaping, about to pronounce some twisted epistle or botched psalm on the verge of a world where there is no such thing as lies, and chaos will be the only science he shall ever love. When you haven't made love in a long time. Whatever first summons back her mouth to yours, gin or lies, or the massive electric wreck of an old man's heart. Whatever rouses your clumsy pulse to its blessed hectic measures, whatever lusty villain's vague halo or blissless wrist you mimic, whatever thoracic harbor your passions thrill in, whatever ashen lie, whatever fragrant muck lets your tongue be neither simple nor mad dash without knowing first the ramshackle angles of angels rising. Do not rush from if to yes. Travel a gentle sickle. Climb her thighs solfeggio. Hush along her hips like some cool crooning devil eager to lose his wits. And I'm going to read, I'm just going to read one short poem, and then I've been working on a longer poem that I'll tell you about in a second. My friend Joseph Legaspi has a book coming out this fall, I think, called Imago. And in Imago, he has a poem called Poem for My Navel. And it's essentially a list poem where he compares his belly button to all these crazy things. So I did it as an exercise with my students, and I said, pick a part of the body that doesn't get a whole lot of attention and write a list poem where you compare that body part to, like, kind of wild things. So I did it with them. Poem for my extra nipple. Burnt out sun, shut eye, stillborn amoeba, minuscule miscarriage of the flesh, ant head, desiccated heart, a volcano's embryo, unborn twin budged through my breast, misplaced knuckle, I let my woman kiss me here, this brown pearl of a Longopo Bay, thorn pierced inch deep into dermis, milkless gland, the aria's last note lost between armpit and sternum. It is a secret passage to the aortic contortions behind my ribs, swollen sand grain from the beach where I watched my brother nearly drown. I pray to it, the singed hint of some great, great grandfather's sin. Come back. So I've been working on this long poem, and I have yet to read it, the parts that feel mostly finished anyway. I've yet to read it from beginning to wherever I'm at right now. So I thought that I would try it here. There's not really a whole lot that you need to know, except for the fact that it's a love poem, and the main characters are Willie and Yolanda, and you know, Willie's just trying to get Yolanda to fall in love with him. That's pretty much what it's all about. The name of the town is Pelea, and it's bordered by a river called the Mestizo River, which joins a freshwater lake and the sea. So it's the mestizaje of water. It's this mixture of it's a brackish river. On the other side is a place called Paz. The whole area used to be called Paz until this river charged through. There's a whole mythology that goes along with this thing, but I won't go into it. In any case, and there's a bridge that connects Paz and Pelea, but they live in Pelea. The lovers of Paz y Pelea Bridge. It's like story time. So just back. Beloved brother Willie every day bragged to Yolanda he could cross 9 times over Paz y Pelea Bridge, carrying her on his back, singing el coro te que bien te ves, and not once let her feet touch the ground. And would she then let him kiss her for 11 sunsets straight? Thing is, beloved brother Will was not known to stack a story thick, i.e. talk shit and not follow through. Like the time Bag and him ran on the same squad, 4-on-4, full court, rocking Tim's and Goose Down, skidding once in a while on a patch of ice, and Willie's man kept scoring, and Bag called him a punk, and Willie said he would stick him with his 7-inch steel if Bag didn't shut up. But Bag was packed with a lot of hot air. And 3 nights later, some demon came to his bed and cut butterflies from his cheeks, and he lived long enough to keep the secret of what quick blade carved those things from his face into flight. We all knew. So nobody fucked with Will when he started reading his bad poems out loud in the moonlight, high as a motherfucker. It wasn't long after Willie would get all twisted when Ash and Ilang Ilang drifted up the whole block to the CeeLo game at the courts. Everyone knew something was wrong that spring because he hit trip sixes and straight up left the G he put down and wandered toward Yolanda's yard of full-blown blossoms to wait for her outside. No one had seen Willie so quiet since his papa tied an extension cord around his ankles and dropped him down the Main Street manhole to dig out the money pouch the old man dropped into the grate the drunken night before in the middle of a storm. His papa wouldn't let him up unless he came back with the pouch, and he did climb back up with the pouch 47 cents short. So his papa made Willie kneel in a corner on tamarind seeds as he whipped the back of his neck with a wooden cross 46 times. really didn't talk for the whole summer or fall, and half the winter he lifted weights and drank all his Tito's rum, quiet like that, until the Tuesday around midnight he was looking to bury a fat pillow of reefer, the best ever in the history of Pasipalea, ever since the surfers came to build the bridge from Rogue to Mother, when they had bales of the luminescent green. But Father Jimmy wasn't having nothing that made people so happy and giggly and likely to talk about oneness with the universe. So after the bridge got built and the surfers went back west, he told everyone they would go to hell if they kept smoking the good shit. Of course, everyone was God-fearing, mostly, but just not Father Jimmy fearing. So the people who smoked weed just kept doing it. Willie had the good shit like that, and decided to bury it in the grassy lot between the church and Father Jimmy's house. But when he started scooping out the ground, he felt a flat knock under the dirt. He pulled out a beat-up book and sat there a while, reading in the language of his dead mother something about bad teeth and falling in love and a boy who turned into wind and a girl into a kite. That's when Willie stopped being so quiet and started singing poems in the moonlight, high as a motherfucker. People say Yolanda had visions. The night, for example, everything got funky for 16 bars. The breakdown, you could say. That was the first time she heard her Lola's eyes open. Even though, story goes, Lola Pansing fell asleep on a cot on a beach because a light-skinned man promised to sail back with a Santa Maria of pure silver. And Lola Pansing waited and waited, but got washed out into Motherland Bay on that cot. Sleeping and sleeping, washed out into the big old waters. And the fish saints to this day watch over her and let her sleep on the sea. They thrash the boats of men who hoard silver in their hulls, and the scuttling sometimes wakes Lola Pansing, and the fish saints' giant tails send gales and rain over those oceans and to the islands, and those grumpy fish saints have to tend the old woman back to sleep. Yolanda can hear her Lola on the verge of waking, long before the winds lift whole houses out of their foundations. Some people thought it was bullshit, until Moco set fire to Yolanda's guitar shop, and people could hear her singing from the second floor the song of waves and deep sleep, a song that stings the ocean back with a salt of her own. You could hear her singing over the fires, the strain of bronze and mahogany ripping walls out like fish guts. People say she got a little cooked in that fire. And that's why she's so dark and sexy, and she smells like ilang ilang and ash. No one knows for sure how she survived. And a week after he first got shot down, there was quiet Willie in front of Yolanda's house, smoking cigarettes, kicking the curb, the first squeak of the screen door. Willie shook up and shouted, "Hey, Yolanda, come out with me tonight and pick a star for me to tag on its burning face, your name and mine." And Yolanda said, "Little Will, you don't know nothing but thuggin' and dice. You don't know nothing about names and stars. Besides, who needs stars when I shine?" And Brother Willie stomped back into the night to drink rum with the tios and smoke trees alone between the church and Father Jimmy's and read from the book about teeth and the man who survived a crossbow through the skull. And every story was about Yolanda. Yolanda Moon and Yolanda Street, rapid fire Yolanda and Yolanda Slow Ice. So, Big Brother Will, the next morning, snapped a dozen reeds and an armful of cattails from the Mestizo River banks. There is, the Dios used to say to him, a science to the snare. You can't want the bird too bad. And you have to wait for the game with your belly pressed to the ground, lying face down, they said. And it takes 1 hour to forget the skin, half the morning to forget the smallest muscle of the foot, 2 mornings more to forget the tongue, and 1 summer week to learn to ruin the heart's puny rush in the blood. And this is how Willie forgot himself into the earth beneath him, not a flinch or breath or pulse. This is how he mastered his body into stone and waited for the bird to step across the twig trigger and into the flat noose, struck on the wing by the reed bundle snapped out of its strained arc. You need a long stillness, the Titos would say, before a quick recall of the blood and its muddy hunger, and the bird stunned to a black blur, snatched. And that is how, as it was taught from man to boy and carried by fist into manhood's darkest precincts, as it was taught to Willie, he cut the bird's tongue so it could learn to repeat everything it would hear. And this is how Willie of the trip sixes, Willie of the bad pickup line, Willie of the quick steel infused left hand and had caught his mimic, pinched open its beak, and severed the small gray shaft from the tiny mouth, and a week and some days more, sleepless Willie sauntered to Yolanda's full-blossomed yard, placed the cage on the fence post, and waited, not long at all, for Yolanda of the nameless star to come out from behind the door she peeked from, for she walked straight up to the smiling Willie of the crooked teeth, and kick them in the knee.
Water break.
So Willie's trying to... The bird trick doesn't work. And Yolanda carried that cage by foot all the way to the third hill from Bas to free this bird among all the other birds with collars of rust around their black necks, whose tongues had been severed for epics by Tios and Pelea before they had forgotten what it was like to live in Bas. The birds that finally escaped and convened in these trees to teach each other an impeccable mimicry of this silly village. This is how they knew the language of men, but also how they knew their violins and lies and laughter, and their foolish engines puttering down, the raucous generations of Pelea clamoring in the trees, and Yolanda paused long enough to hear the thin ching of a 7-inch steel on skin and a cocoon's first break. She paused long enough to listen to the bird of her own voice singing salt and sting long before Moko, who had ears of a mule, dragged her into an alley, and she heard from the bird of Moko's voice, which was the bird of her voice too, saying in the trees, I want to smell your hair. And she heard the bird sing again, the oncoming footsteps outside the alley, and her head's thud against the wall after the man with the ears of a mule shoved her down and ran off. But the birds did not, could not speak the sound of the first flint spark behind the eyes. And what sound could they make for the 12-year-old girl plucking the longest locks from her brush the first morning after she was shoved into an alley by a man with the ears and breath of a mule? And how he whispered to her with his mule breath, I want to smell your hair. There was no sound from the birds for the way every Sunday for a year she twisted those strands she collected from her brush, twisted them in the direction of clocks into a single strand. And it took 9 years of plucking from her brush and twisting the fine threads in the direction of clocks to make 4 separate strands, each the full length of a man from his toe to the tip of his ears, even if such ears were those of a mule. 9 years of twisting every Sunday, her stray hair in the same direction the earth turns around the sun. But it took only one afternoon to braid those 4 strands, one for each dimension of loneliness perfected in the town of Pelea, and weave them into a rope. And if each strand was twisted in the same direction as the earth turns around the sun, the same direction of clocks, then these 4 strands were to be braided in the opposite direction, braided to one another against time. That was how one fashioned the strongest rope. This one, thick as her thumb and forefinger, this one smelled of ilang ilang and a touch of ash. The birds, they had no song for any of this, though they had a song for the bright bath of sunlight Yolanda stepped into, clutching her crafted rope the length of a man. A song, too, for the effortless way she grabbed Moko by the ears like a jack or hare, and the way she strangled his thick mule neck till he turned the color of a rotting strawberry. And how the other men in that summer sun bath playing dominoes did not stop her, because Moko could not hold the secrets of his lust and bragged to everyone how he once tasted the hair of the girl who was part burn and part blossom. And because Moko, even without his ears, was twice the height of the shortest men in Pelea, he fell over with a great thud trying to remember air. A man who has forgotten the ocean must dream of it, must feel the coral cutting his ankles to bone, the flayed anatomy of light filtering down the sky's gray abrasions that changes everything it touches to a fog he can't take into his lungs. He must taste brine and gasp and feel the pure silver of his breastbone on the verge of breaking, must gasp and hack and know the baddest breakdown of riptides. He must learn to breathe underwater. So I will finish You know, I've been following all week the stuff that's been going on in Virginia Tech. Just trying to figure things out. I don't know. I've thought a lot about madness and violence in my own poems. I don't know, but I thought of this poem. It's a trilogy. There are three prose poems. The first one is it's about a man who loses his mind. The second is in the voice of his dead mother, and the third is an address to the man himself. His name is Boulevard. Thank you all for coming. The Boulevard Trilogy. One. How Boulevard lost his mind. Boulevard was tired of all the slow birds in his brain, the awkward leaden ones with lazy plumage and ponderous toes. They were rude, painful, and fat. They had little eyes. Their sloppy tongues lapped him up in a noxious drool. So one day he swatted one to the corner and replaced it with a quick and lovely swallow. How it flit and soared and seemed to be many places at one time. The swallow danced and dove with its mouth open, taking into its little belly whole throatfuls of his mind's sky. It lived on the swaths of heaven, left blank by the torpid bird which Boulevard thought he had rid himself of. They say the sky will double at least once during a man's lifetime, and so it did in Boulevard's head. But turgid birds came three by three and then some to fling themselves about. So we swatted them away too. To fill the aching gapes of heaven, he invited another swallow, then two, then three, their flashy undersides, a dazzle and distraction, then nuthatch, then murder birds, then uncountable dozens more. This is how he thought he'd save himself, but soon enough, his whole brain had become a madness of wings. A squeaky starling racket, grackles darkening him to a translucent blue, pigeons fucking on the rooftops, maimed gray swans, and those first swift birds still slamming themselves against cranial walls until his skull filled up. And this is how Boulevard lay down his head, all heavy with pretty corpses and the dread. Two, the ghost of Boulevard's mother, Trick. In the kitchen, which is no longer my kitchen, I select the blade, choose the fruit, hear the chopping board clap against the counter. I want the after sting of shrimp paste, ginger, salt. I slice a ripe bitter melon lengthwise to scoop the seeds. I cut the middle bit and feel the dull push of the knife against my skin and see the nick fill with pink and swell. I'll catch a glimpse of me, a wince against the fading light and the trick of the eye, a figment of fish and steam. The woman who cooks here now, who lies in my husband's bed, she says my name at night. She's half awake, shuddering like a feverish child, except the heat in her forehead and hands, the burn between her legs, is me. I enter her the way night floods an empty jug. Sometimes I find myself in her wrists as she brushes her hair from her eyes. I feel her breasts weighing heavily to one side or another. I can almost get up and walk, almost leave my husband breathing deeply, twitching. I can nearly find my way to the kitchen blind. I am in her throat and on her tongue. I ride the breaths that pass between her lips. So when she says my name, I am almost speaking again. Three, to Boulevard. Waking. Yes, it troubles me. The way morning comes on, giving up its bright belly, how the shadow's edges cut the streets into a dagger's angles. It's not midnight or the heat of high noon that I've come to love. It's the 9 minutes that aren't night, aren't dawn, after an evening of little sleep, when I dream of beating senseless a stranger who will not drop until I take a crowbar or axe to his shoulder, and still he won't stay down. It's in a place I keep calling home, but I don't even know where to find the closest door. And there's always a woman who comes along. She's resurrected from the dead. She smells of gardenia, which reminds me of a Spanish name. And the woman, she is always coming back to life like this, reanimated from seaweed and brush, sugarcane and stone. One time, I remember she had a limp and a long scar down her left arm. She was singing, no words really, and no melody. It was a falsetto she hummed to me as a child, a glissando lost in heat and glass. It's the morning when I think I got nothing to keep me, no memory of anguish, no harm to my teeth or hazard to my knees, alive. And I'm wrong. I have 9 minutes, and I have the stranger. I have the strange song. Thank you.